Give Theory a Chance. In this episode, we are joined by Dr. Jackie Frost, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Purdue University and a Faculty Research Fellow in the Religion and Public Life Program at Rice University. In our conversation, Jackie discusses her early encounters with Max Weber as an undergraduate at the University of Wyoming and why she did not initially connect with his ideas. She then helps us understand the value of drawing on Weber's work and testing his predictions through her research on ritual and community in non-religious congregations and her collaboration with Dr. Penny Edgell, exploring how people discuss contemporary social controversies. Hi, Jackie. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We are here today to talk about Max Weber. Could you get us going by just giving a short introduction to who he was, or perhaps rather what he's known for?
Yeah, definitely. So Weber was I'd call him a German intellectual. He sort of dabbled in a lot of different things, but he became a prominent social theorist in sort of the late 1800s, early 1900s. His work has been really influential in sociology. And along with Karl Marx and Emil Durkheim, he's considered to be one of the fathers of sociology and a central figure in sort of the development of social sciences. So I'd say he's probably most well known for his book, Economy and Society, but his essay, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, is also highly cited. And he's done lots of other highly cited essays and lectures examining things like world religions, bureaucracy and the state. He has lectures on science and politics as a vocation, where he outlines his theories about charismatic authority and the relationship between science and religion in the modern world. I would say it's big sort of contributions.
Okay, so clearly everyone in sociology knows the name Max Weber, or they have a sense of who he is. He's widely accepted as one of the founders of the field. But what I'm curious about is, do you get a sense that he's widely read or engaged with beyond that experience in grad school, where you have that semester or two of theory and you have to read some excerpts from Weber, you have to read the key book from Weber? Do people continue to engage with his ideas?
Yeah, I think he is still very widely used, at least in the subfields I'm in. So I'm very much in the sociology of religion space, and he's very much a touch point for many sociologists of religion. He's one of the sort of prominent theorists of secularization. He talks a lot about the relationship between religion and science. He did a lot of work on different world religions. So he is very much a touch point in sociology of religion debates. But I think he's a pretty common touch point for a lot of contemporary sociologists in, law, organizations, those kinds of subfields. I think he, like the other founders, they sort of started conversations that we are all still sort of engaging with. And so even if it's sort of just one citation or whatever, you sort of have to know what Weber said, I think, to enter into a lot of discussions in sociology. So my sense is he's still pretty widely read.
Yeah, and I suppose because he wrote so extensively and because a huge chunk of his writing was that kind of encyclopedic, definitional style of work, we can read different types of Weber
parts. Yeah, exactly.
So the Weber that I read that I find useful might be different than the Weber you read, or might be different than someone who's studying international organizations.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so when did you first encounter Weber? Do you remember the first time that you read his work?
So I remember reading some Economy and Society in my undergrad theory course, but I wasn't really grabbed by it at the time.
Yeah.
I sort of wasn't very interested in like bureaucracy and capitalism. It was sort of over my head, I think. I was very into like Irving Goffman and Herbert Mead and doing sort of the microsociology, theorizing our everyday interactions.
Well, sorry to interrupt. Do you think was it the topic or the writing? And I always wonder that, because I think Weber's ideas, once you get them, are actually pretty exciting, but the writing is so dry.
I'll talk about this a little. I do have some very, I think he's actually a pretty good writer. I think he's got a lot of interesting one-liners, but at the time I think, the writing was a bit dry for me, and sort of, I was 18 or whatever. I didn't really have a good grasp on like bureaucracy and what capitalism was. And I wasn't as interested in that as, other topics that we were covering, like religion or race or, microsociology. So I'm still very interested in Irving Goffman. But I was assigned, we didn't read The Protestant Ethic in undergrad, as far as I remember, but it was one of the first things I was assigned in my graduate theory course. And that's when I really think I started to appreciate Weber's more macro approach to social theory and started getting interested in his arguments about the ways that religious beliefs can have an important impact on the direction of social structures. I was really sort of a burgeoning sociologist of religion, and the Protestant ethic was one of the first sort of introductions I had into the ways I could use my interest in religion to sort of do big theory and make a real contribution to conversations in sociology.
You know, I think it was almost a side point that you made, but where we encounter theorists at different points in our own life course with our own experiences matter. And I think sometimes, at least I forget that when I'm in the classroom teaching. So I think about how much bureaucracy influences my own life. And I'm like, oh, of course, this is the part that will really connect with someone. And they'll be able to say, oh, yeah, I had that experience. And students are starting to experience that, right? You have to deal with financial aid. But that's not really the most important thing in their life at that point when you're 18 years old. And so it makes sense that you would be more drawn to someone like Goffman, right? Because you're doing so much face work. You're doing so much presentation itself.
Yeah,
at that
and
point.
You're sort of like very self-conscious, right? And I thought it was very interesting to sort of read about, you know, and that like you could, you know, your job could be sort of just watching people do micro interactions. I found that very, very interesting, and sort of the bigger macro theorists felt really big and a bit over my head at the time. But as you know, I stayed in sociology and kept reading and had more experience out in the world, I feel like theorists like Weber started to have more of an impact.
No, that's fascinating. I need to think about that more when I teach, because I'm always like, well, why does this bureaucracy stuff? Why isn't this exciting to you? Like, don't you hate it? And they're like, I don't care about that.
Yeah, once you realize, you're like, oh, this is actually the core of how society is structured, and it really does matter.
And so, all right, so you had that experience. You were starting to make more of a connection, especially as you were thinking about religion. What drew you back to his writings? Why did you decide to return to them? Or did you decide to return to them? I guess is a better question.
I think so. And this will sort of preview some of what I'll say throughout the podcast. I think in really digging into Weber in my grad theory course, both in sort of his work in religion, but also his work on sort of the bureaucracy and on bureaucracy in the state. I found it, you know, very, like I said, sort of inspiring how he was doing big theory around religion. But I also, I felt not that he was wrong, but that he was sort of too pessimistic for me. And so in terms of, I think that he identified, like I think you said, he sort of like categorizes the world in very sort of clear ways. And he has his ideal types, right? So he has big ideas. He makes these really bold claims. And I think he's right about a lot of things, but I feel like he was really pessimistic about the way that society was going, about the way that modernization worked. And in my work with non-religious folks, which I can talk about more in a minute, I found that they weren't sort of embodying the ideal type of a secular person that he was sort of theorizing. And so I would read Weber and be like, oh, this is really interesting, but I think he might be a little wrong here. And so I would continue to go back and sort of question if he was right, or if what he theorized would be happening was present in the data I was collecting.
Which is how theory should work. And it's kind of funny. I think sometimes when we're taught classic theory, we forget that. Weber's writing about a different world than we're encountering. So it would be strange if every single thing he said was correct, right?
Yeah. But we often, you know, especially as early students, we're like, oh, they're the founders. They must be right about everything, and they must have gotten this all right, and they're so prescient. And at first, that's sort of how I, you know, approach these big theorists. But then you're like, oh, well, it's, you know, they weren't quite right about this. They didn't predict this correctly, those kinds of things. And so once I realized I could critique Weber, I was like, oh, this opens up a whole new sort of, foil for me to sort of think about how my work is related.
And then, so was there a particular idea from Weber's that you found either captivating, or you said, well, this is an area that it seems important, but I could potentially add to and correct?
Yeah, I think both. So ideas that I found captivating and sort of really influenced me again was sort of the Protestant ethic argument in general. So it's a big long essay about how, you know, especially Calvinists, but sort of the religious beliefs and values of Protestants shaped economic structures, right? So like the idea that the Protestant ethic sort of drove Calvinists to want to prove that they were people who would be saved by God by doing work out in the world. This idea that our religious beliefs could really influence big social structures was something I thought was really exciting and I wanted to think more about. And I think also in that essay, he has his sort of famous line about how ideas are like railroad switchmen, right? Yeah. So it's the ideas like switchmen have determined the tracks along which action has been pushed, I think is what he said, something like that.
That sounds like his language.
Something, but I really like that idea of, and I think it sort of inspired me to go more into the sociology of culture route, right? This, his sort of talking about how we don't typically think about cultural values and religious values as being important drivers of economic structures or big social structures. And so I thought that was really interesting. And I liked how he was working with religion in that way. But then, so I like that idea, but I think the way that he talks about secularization and about what happens when societies modernize, that's where I started to disagree with him. So I can sort of walk you through that if you're interested in.
Yeah, no, I'd love to hear that, because I think that's one of the challenges, especially when you're, whether you're encountering grad school or as a professor, but especially when you're an undergrad, like you were saying, these ideas are so grand and all-encompassing. So even if you have a sense that something's not quite right, what do you do with it? So I'm really curious how it's, what you've done in your own work and how you've gone about engaging with it.
So one of his sort of most well-known arguments, I think, or at least in sociology of religion, is that the modern world has and will continue to become increasingly disenchanted. So his disenchantment thesis is very popular and cited. And so his argument is that there, as we sort of have more and more scientific discoveries and scientific advances in modern society, that things like religion and magic and spirituality, that they'll start to decline and we'll sort of turn to science rather than religion to answer both day-to-day questions about, you know, like how do things work, but also big existential questions about, like, you know, why are we here and where do we come from and what's our purpose? And so he argued that as a result of this sort of scientification of society and modernization, that the world would become more secular, right? Religion would decline, and thus the world would become less enchanting, and that people would have less to grab onto in terms of meaning, in terms of transcendent experiences, in terms of answering these big existential questions with something that sort of is meaningful to them. And so in a lot of my work, I push back against this narrative of disenchantment. A lot of people, I call it, I think I stole it from Charles Taylor maybe, but this idea of the subtraction story of secularization, that if we lose religion, then we also lose community, we lose meaning, we lose ritual, we lose social connection, we lose our health and well-being. There's a lot of theories in sociology of religion that are sort of bound up in this Weberian theory of the world of this sort of decline as religion declines. And so my work is focused on better understanding the non-religious people in the United States. So the atheists, agnostics, there's about 30% of Americans now who are not religiously affiliated. And so in my work, I'm finding that the non-religious don't really conform to this sort of stereotype that he constructed in his theories about what a secular world might be or what a secular person might be. They are not filled with sort of existential dread. They have plenty of places to sort of find meaning and community. So for example, my dissertation was an ethnographic case study of an atheist church called the Sunday Assembly. So this is exactly what it sounds like. Atheists who meet on Sundays to sing songs together, to create community, to engage in rituals together, all around their sort of non-religious secular beliefs. So I've written a number of papers about how the Sunday Assembly and other atheist churches like it are really evidence that secularization doesn't necessarily mean a decline in meaning or a decline in sort of community, or that science itself can't be a space for meaning and sort of transcendence. So a lot of atheists that I interview think about science as something to sacralize. So a lot of these atheist churches are spaces where they talk about science together, they think about scientific advancements together, they sort of have awe and wonder about science and nature. And so in a lot of my work, I'm pushing back against Weber's sort of pessimistic view of what secularization would bring for meaning and values.
Okay, I hope this makes sense. This question. So you still find Weber useful because he provides a foundation where you can say, one would think this would happen, but we find something contrary to that, right? Because that's necessary for you, instead of simply saying, we don't need Weber. He shapes the questions we would ask, but we could just move on without even mentioning him.
Mm. Yeah, I think with that example, so there are a lot of theorists who make this argument about the decline of religion and its consequences. So I don't necessarily think you need Weber for that, but I do think he made one of the most explicit arguments, especially about disenchantment, right? That is sort of an easy thing to grab onto to sort of speak against or speak with, right? So I think he's a good starting point to say, like, sociologists tend to think this is sort of the narrative of modernization. And that really started with not just Weber, but Weber, Marx, and Durkheim all sort of had this similar narrative. But he was sort of the strongest, I think, in terms of this disenchantment theory. But other work I've done that really does sort of need Weber, I would say, is more in the sort of bureaucracy side of his work, which isn't something I'm as familiar with. But he had sort of a similar pessimistic view of bureaucracy in the state, right? So, you know, his theory definitely. Of the iron cage and how, you know, modern bureaucracies sort of don't allow for a lot of freedom or emotion or autonomy. And so in a paper that I worked on with Penny Edgel at University of Minnesota on the Talking About Social Controversies project that she did, and I know you worked with her some on that.
And I need to get Penny on this podcast also.
Yeah.
She's awesome. And for some reason, I keep inviting everyone who's worked with Penny, but I haven't talked to Penny yet.
Yeah, get Penny on here. So in that project, I worked with her. We set out to test Weber's theories of, I guess, just his one theory of his sort of logics of social action. So his argument is that there's sort of universal logics of action that people use to decide what to do and what the right thing to do is in any given situation. And so some of them were sort of instrumental logics, right? So using science to decide what to do or using law to decide what to do versus values-based or what he called substantive rationalities, right? So using religious beliefs or using what feminist theorists call caring logics, right? So instead of deciding, you know, the law says this is what we have to do, instead sort of focusing on human individual sort of needs and emotions and making decisions based on what one person needs rather than like what society needs, right? So his argument is that as society modernizes, rationalities become more instrumental and less values-based. And so people are less able to sort of take individuals into account when making big decisions about social controversies, right? And so Penny and I wanted to test this. And so she had 48 focus groups, I think it was, and we coded all of those focus groups using Weber's typology of logics of action. So were people using scientific evidence to make decisions about? So in these focus groups, people were sort of given a fictional vignette where there was a social controversy that had something to do with religion, with science, and or with law. And so they had to sort of pick, you know, which they decided they would use to reason with.
This is giving me so many flashbacks because I ran the focus groups in Boston. So now I'm having that. This is such an amazing use of the data. This is great. Keep going. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay. Yeah. No, you're fine. So we use that data to code every instance when someone said, okay, here's what I think we should do. Here's what the right thing to do in this fictional social controversy we've been presented with. Coded them as, are they saying we should do what science says we should do? Are they saying we should do what the law says? Are they saying we should do the most efficient thing, right? Those are the three sort of instrumental rationalities Weber would say are dominant in sort of modern societies, right? Efficiency, science, and law. These are all supposed to be universal logics that apply to everyone and don't really take anybody's sort of individual circumstances or emotions into account. But feminist theorists like Joan Tronto and Carol Gilligan have argued that Weber was sort of wrong in thinking that the more values-based logics aren't still present in modern society. And they were particularly interested in a logic of care, right? This idea that especially women and people doing care work tend to make arguments about, you know, we should do what's the most caring thing rather than what's the most efficient thing. And so Weber argued that, you know, in a situation like an academic situation, people would be more likely to grab onto these instrumental logics rather than caring logics. And so we coded all of these focus groups for both the instrumental logics, but also when people were using caring logics. And what we found was that the most common logic used was a values-based logic, and that caring logics, so people would argue against the sort of efficiency or science or law logics to say, no, we can't just do these, we can't just look to science. We have to do what's caring for people.
So what would be an example, like just so we can mm-hmm. fully understand, what would be an example of how someone would articulate a caring logic?
Yeah. Yeah, so one of the vignettes that focus groups would have to talk through is the idea of, should we have a Christian-specific ministry given to prisoners? So this brings up a lot of things in terms of religion, like separation of church and state, right? So is it legal to have one religious group come in and sort of give opportunities to prisoners who are willing to sort of join a Christian group, right? So people who aren't Christian in prisons would probably get less access to this or be less interested in it. And people, the idea was the people who would participate in this Christian ministry would also get benefits, like, you know, extra phone calls or free time or extra visits with family or whatever it was. And so a lot of people would come out in that vignette and say, well, this isn't fair, right? This isn't sort of legal, or this isn't universally fair. Not everyone would be able to participate. But others would say, well, if at least one person sort of benefited from this, then I think it's worth it, right? Because individuals still need care, and individuals who are Christians would still benefit from this. So I think some people would argue against this logic of fairness for a logic of it would help some people. That would be one example of that.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So in that study, I think you really do need Weber, because I think he was, you know, we did find that his sort of logics of action were very much the ones that were present. We didn't find a bunch of other kinds of logics of action people were using. So he was right that these are sort of the dominant logics that are used, but he wasn't as right in terms of which ones were so dominant. And he sort of missed the agency, I think, that people have in terms of pushing back against these more efficiency-based logics or universal logics that he was so worried were creating this iron cage. And so we sort of argued that people have more agency to push back against them, and using caring logics is one of them. But there are a lot of other values-based logics that we found in the paper that people were using that aren't really accounted for, I think, in his theory. So I think Weber is a great starting point, because he has all these great ideal types and these great sort of categories of things. And then to go out and test them, I think, is really useful and see if they really ring true in modern society.
Yeah. And again, sorry if this is just repeating you, but it shows the strength of that definitional style writing of his, because it allows you such a clear starting point that you can go out and then gather empirical data and then test it.
Yeah.
You already did this a bit, but I'm wondering, considering your research, are there other theorists that you see Weber working particularly well with?
There are plenty of theorists who are in this sort of what are the causes and consequences of modernization camp, right? So Anthony Giddens, Charles Taylor, Peter Berger, there are many others who I would say, Robert Putnam even, who sort of not necessarily agree with everything Weber said, but sort of have this sort of bigger narrative of here's what modernization means for, you know, different things, you know, community or well-being or whatever it might be. And many theorists, I think, agree with this sort of, at least the general narrative of religious decline brings decline in other areas of life. I often group Weber in with those when I'm sort of setting up my idea of, like, you know, sociology tends to theorize modernization in a particular way. So I think he fits in with a lot of those theorists. And I think because they're building from him, right? He's sort of one of the starting points of this conversation. But I think also in the logics of action paper, we also put him in conversation with social psychologists like Jonathan Haidt, who were theorizing moral logics. So we have in sociology, but we have like institutional logics, right? Like, here are the logics that different institutions use. We have moral logics. Here are the different moral logics that individuals use. And Weber's sort of logics of social action sort of bridged those in some ways. And so in that paper, we sort of put all three of those theories of logic in conversation with each other to sort of make a larger argument about how people make decisions.
I need to read all the papers that you've done recently. All these sound, they, I mean, they all sound really great. Okay, so here's almost a pre-final question, just based on something that you mentioned earlier. So you said when you first encountered Weber that you did not necessarily connect and enjoy reading, but then you also mentioned as a little side that you think he is a decent writer. And that, so what was the shifting point where you actually can sit down with Weber and enjoy reading the text? Is it because you had research projects, topics in mind, so it made it something that you could read with a purpose? or was it your maturing as an academic? Like, I'm just wondering what that is. For me, sometimes the most difficult texts make more sense when I know why I'm reading it. And when you're 18, you don't. And when you're a grad student, you're like, oh, but I want to study this thing. I don't know. I'm curious for you what that shift was.
Yeah.
Like, why are you at a point where you can actually sit down with Vapor and read it?
And enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a mixture of all of those things, you know, like when I started taking sociology classes, I did it because I was interested in understanding how humans worked and why humans did what they did. But I didn't quite understand the use of theory yet, I think. And so, you know, I grabbed onto things that were a little more contemporary and a little more, I felt at the time, like made more sense in my social world. But like we were talking about, right, like as I sort of got older and sort of started to understand, you know, different aspects of how the world worked, I think that these big theorists started to make more sense. I think I also just got better at reading theory, right? So I think it's a skill that you develop that you can't just come to theory and really know how to read it, especially these older theories where it's like these big armchair theories, right? Of like, they're just theorizing the whole world with no real data and I didn't quite understand how to read that. And so I think it was hard for me to just even get started with it, you know? And so yeah. I wasn't really reading for enjoyment. And so, but I think you're right that once you have, oh, I want to study non-religious people, here's what these theorists seem to be saying, or at least the sort of implications of what they're saying are for how non-religious people are, or what they believe, or whatever it might be. Then I think it is a little easier to start digging in and really engaging with it. But I, you know, and people often call the, especially like Karl Marx, Emile Durkheim and Max Weber dry, but I disagree. I think they have some of the most interesting sort of turns of phrase. I assigned science as a vocation to a freshman class recently, and they were just very upset about it, but like in a very engaged way. They were like, he's just making such big claims, and he has all of these really interesting metaphors about, you know, scientists and how scientists do work. So I think that if you can give students the context for it and sort of give them some questions to try to answer with it, I think that it is a little easier to start digging into it.
All right, final question. And this is kind of big picture, reflecting on the projects that you've been engaged with, the papers that you've published, but also your experience in the classroom assigning some of Weber's works. What would you say are the advantages or selling points of engaging with Weber's writings? And maybe this is for me as much as listeners, because when I teach theory, it's combined classic and contemporary. I can't teach all of it. And I'm constantly cutting more of the traditional things so I can get more contemporary theory in there. And I don't know. I still haven't figured out the balance. So maybe I'm the audience that you're trying to convince, but why should we still undertake the task of reading Weber's work?
Yeah.
Or if you're the student who's assigned this work, why should you actually make the effort to read it?
I think with Weber and all these founding theorists, you know, like we're having important conversations about in sociology and in social science in general about how, you know, the founders shouldn't be the only central people that we're reading, and how it's very, you know, they were white men and that's obviously problematic. There were people of color and women doing theory at the same time that aren't, you know, focused on as much as the founders. And so I absolutely agree that we need to decenter the people like Weber. But I also do agree with the side of the argument that he was part of the start of a big conversation that we're all still having, right? And so a lot of the work, a lot of the contemporary theorists that one might assign in a theory class are often speaking back to Weber in some ways, right? Even if not explicitly, but often explicitly. And so I think it's useful for students to at least know where that's coming from, and at least to have some exposure to that style of writing, that style of theory, because I think it's also changed over time, right? I think I've used Weber to sort of open up a conversation about how theories can be wrong, and how we can sort of, how that's good. That's a good thing, right? Like it's good to sort of put big ideas out there and then have them tested. And it's not a bad thing necessarily to be critiqued or to be sort of built on in your work, because that's what we've done with Weber, right? Like I don't agree with everything that he said, but it's a useful sort of tool, thinking tool. And I think it's,
and that's why we're sociologists. Yeah. We should be figuring out how to combine those, that grand theorizing those ideas with the empirical things that we observe.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think it's a good lesson for students to understand what we, you know, what it means to call people founders of a field, where the problems in that are, where the benefits in having a central sort of set of texts are, and having that conversation with them about how the social world changes and how social theory can change as a result. And I think it's exciting for students to understand that these big names aren't right in everything, right? I think that I have had students be like, oh yeah, I've never really thought about reading something like this with a critical eye.
Yeah.
And I think that they find that empowering in some ways.
Thank you again for stopping by. Thank you for talking through Weber. Thank you for sharing your research. I enjoyed this. This makes me more excited about Weber. So
I don't know if that was my goal, but I am glad.
Appreciation goes to Jeffrey Gilbert for providing theme music, SUNY Brockport for providing financial support, and most importantly, on behalf of me, Kyle Green, thank you for giving theory a chance.